Drop the J-E-Y and you have L.L. Bean. Our winner this week is Harold, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
Mr. Rabbit, Mr. Rabbit, your ears are mighty long. Yes, don't you know they were put on wrong? Every little soul's gonna shine, shine. Every little soul's gonna shine along.
For the new puzzle, send me three words for baby animals. If you change an L to a T, you will have exactly two of each letter used. So again, I'm looking for three words for baby animals. Combine all the letters and change an L to a T, and you will have exactly two of each letter. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
Yes, there are things that I'm still so afraid of, but my courage is roaring like the sound of the sun, cause it's vain about its mane and will reveal.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of April 1st. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 4th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, Matea Carlin, and Birdie. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for the Global Citizen International Digest next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. The latest on the Israel-Hamas war. China's leader stresses food security. And North Korea continues to flout UN sanctions. First, in the Israel-Hamas war. When the UN Security Council resolved on March 24 by a 14-0 vote with the US abstaining to demand an immediate ceasefire, an immediate freeing of hostages, and a major increase in humanitarian aid deliveries, how did the concerned parties react? The Israeli government, in a pique, decided not to send a delegation to Washington that was supposed to engage with the U.S. national security officials on the Rafah incursion. Hamas also has rejected the resolution's demands. It wants a permanent ceasefire, assurances on humanitarian aid deliveries, and the safe return to the north of Gaza's displaced citizens. Negotiations continue in Cairo. Despite the Biden-Netanyahu rift, the president has given the green light to yet another arms delivery, this one reportedly worth as much as $18 billion. The new arms packages include more than 1,800 2,000-pound bombs and 500 500-pound bombs, as well as F-15 jet fighters. Biden acknowledged, quote, the pain being felt by Arab Americans over the war, but that pain did not keep him from authorizing another weapons delivery. The decision comes as Francesca Albanese, the UN special reporter on human rights in the Palestinian territories, called for an arms embargo on Israel, saying in her report there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel is guilty of genocide. And finally, on the Israeli political front, Prime Minister Netanyahu faces not only 4 days of mass protests, but also a major crisis over the role of the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredi, in military service. Since Israel's founding, the Haredi, who now constitute about 13% of Israel's population, have been exempt from military service and have had their own educational system in return for supporting a secular state. Now, in the wake of the October 7 Hamas attack, demands have grown to remove those privileges. That would probably end ultra-Orthodox support of Netanyahu's government. On the other hand, if an agreement is reached that would extend those privileges, his non-religious supporters might rebel. China's leader stresses food security. Food security has historically been a major concern of China's leaders. In more recent years, as supply chains have become less reliable, tensions with the West have increased, Chinese and farm areas have been drawn to the cities, and water supplies have become scarcer, food security is very much on the political agenda. That was clear from Xi Jinping's recent visit to Hunan province. He seemed to make a particular point about the province's role in China's food security, saying, "With a population of over 1.4 billion, China's food security must be ensured by ourselves. Chinese people's rice bowls should primarily contain Chinese grain," unquote. "It is necessary to build high-standard farmland," he said, "promote moderate-scale operations, strengthen policy support and demonstration guidance, increase the promotion of better quality varieties of seeds, quality machinery, and quality practice methods, make efforts in meticulous farming in order to further increase both the yield and quality of grain, allowing grain producers to prosper, thereby further attract more farmers to participate in the development of modern, large-scale agriculture." Finally, he said Hunan province should shoulder the heavy responsibility of safeguarding national food security and called on the region to, quote, "accelerate breakthroughs in core technologies in key fields such as the seed industry and agricultural machinery." North Korea continues to flout UN sanctions. On March 18 and 20, two UN reports highlighted North Korea's evasion of UN sanctions and its deplorable human rights conditions. On sanctions, a UN panel of experts released its final report for 2023. The report said the DPRK, that is the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, had, quote, "continued to flout Security Council sanctions. It further developed nuclear weapons and produced nuclear fissile materials, although its last known nuclear test took place in 2017, unquote. North Korea launched, quote, "at least 7 ballistic missiles, 1 3-stage intercontinental ballistic missile, 1 possible intermediate-range ballistic missile, and 5 short-range ballistic missiles. It also placed a military observation satellite into orbit using ballistic missile technology and added a tactical nuclear attack submarine to its missile arsenal. North Korea also evaded UN sanctions on petroleum imports, and its illegal exports of conventional arms and munitions is under investigation. Nevertheless, within the past week, Russia has withdrawn support from the panel of experts, ending its over 20 years of reporting on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs. Also being investigated by the UN are 58 cyber attacks by North Korea on companies that deal in cyber currency, $3 billion worth, and North Korean overseas workers who are earning money in violation of sanctions. The earnings from these activities and the country's access to the international financial system are believed tied to North Korean military budgeting. On human rights conditions in the DPRK, the UN Special Rapporteur reported that it had been 10 years since a UN Commission of Inquiry had first concluded that, quote, "systemic, widespread, and gross human rights violations have been and are being committed by the DPRK, its institutions, and officials, and such violations constitute crimes against humanity." The commission recommended that the country, quote, "undertake profound political and institutional reforms, and that the international community take several actions, including referral to the International Criminal Court." That report was followed up by another in 2017 by a group of independent experts, quote, "to seek accountability for human rights violations, in particular those amounting to crimes against humanity," unquote. Almost needless to say, the special rapporteur was unable to report any progress either on ameliorating human rights conditions in North Korea or gaining accountability for the violations. In other news, a Palestinian poll on the war and the future. In my Tuesday broadcast, I reported on the results of a poll of Palestinian opinion conducted by a highly respected, independent Palestinian research organization. About 1,500 people in Gaza and the West Bank were polled. In case you missed it, here are some of the principal findings. 60% of all Gazans say a member of their family has been killed during the current war. Almost two-thirds blame Israel for their suffering, and most of the others blame the U.S. In the Gaza Strip, only 9% blame Hamas. While support for Hamas's October 7 attack remains high, Palestinian support in the West Bank has in fact dropped by 11 points, while support in the Gaza Strip has increased by 14 points. Almost all Palestinians think Israel is committing war crimes, while almost all believe Hamas is not committing war crimes. Moreover, more than 90% believe that Hamas did not commit any atrocities against Israeli civilians during its October 7 attack. Only 1 in 5 Palestinians has seen videos showing atrocities committed by Hamas. 38% of Gazans expect the war to continue and increasingly believe Hamas will win the war. 60% now think Hamas will be in control after the war. Gazans' support for continued Hamas control over the Gaza Strip has increased to almost 50%, a 14% rise. Palestinians in the West Bank have very different views, mostly believing Hamas will not win the war and will not be in control of the Gaza Strip. And finally, two findings that are especially important. Support for the two-state solution has increased significantly, and support for armed struggle has dropped significantly. However, the increased support for the two-state solution, while dramatic, came only from the Gaza Strip, a 27-point increase, while remaining stable in the West Bank. New security laws in Hong Kong. As though repressive laws in 2020 designed to lock up pro-democracy protesters were not enough, the Beijing-controlled Hong Kong legislature passed another national security law. This one casts a much wider net. As John Lee, the Hong Kong chief executive, said, the new laws would, quote, allow Hong Kong to effectively prevent and put a stop to espionage activities, the conspiracies and traps of intelligence units, and the infiltration and damage of enemy forces, unquote. One would think Hong Kong is besieged with spies and other kinds of foreign interference, but it isn't. It's just that critics and protesters remain. But the new law will also affect multinational investors, journalists, in fact, anyone who might be involved with foreigners in a way that could be construed as external interference or sabotage. From Beijing's viewpoint, the new security law accomplishes what a previous attempt to pass one in 2003 did not. On that occasion, the population rose up in a massive display of opposition, the so-called Umbrella Revolution, that forced the authorities to back off. Hong Kong was once known for its respect of human rights, its feisty politics, and its home to foreign investment. Now it mirrors the mainland, which recently passed its own anti-espionage legislation and has put foreign firms under the microscope. As one U.S. professor puts it, quote, the Hong Kong leaders seem to be looking for ways to signal their fealty to the government's national security agenda and to ensure that they are demonstrating no daylight between themselves and the Chinese government. What does China want? Two seemingly contradictory views. Do China's leaders want a world in which their country is regarded as a peer of the U.S. and is seriously interested in finding common ground? Or do they want to dominate in Asia and find ways to get rid of the U.S. presence there? Xi Jinping has said on numerous occasions that he favors the former view. Most recently, he repeated it in a meeting with senior U.S. business executives and other influentials on U.S.-China relations. According to Xinhua, the New China News Agency, Xi emphasized the importance of a positive China-U.S. relationship, saying, quote, the two countries' respective success is an opportunity for each other. As long as both sides see each other as partners and show mutual respect, coexist in peace, and cooperate for win-win results, China-U.S. relations will get better. And as he has said many times before, Xi observed that China-U.S. relations are improving, but can do better provided the U.S. does not hinder China's development and pursues cooperative international policies. But the other day, we heard Zhao Leji, a member of Xi's inner circle, the standing committee of the Chinese Communist Party Politburo, voice what amounts to an Asia for Asians view that suggested that the Chinese aim is actually to end the U.S. alliance system in the Pacific. That view was last heard early in Xi's career as leader, but not recently. In a speech at the annual Boao Asia Forum on March 28th, Zhao said, quote, "We must always keep in mind, in our own hands, the future of lasting peace and security in Asia and pass on the torch of peace from generation to generation. We should jointly maintain security in Asia." What should we make of such statements? China's leaders surely don't expect to drive the U.S. out of Asia, but I think they do hope to weaken U.S. alliances that impede Chinese influence, such as with the Philippines and Japan. By the way, the American visitors who met with Xi did not do themselves credit by showering praise on China and its leader, at least according to the New China News Agency. The group is said to have praised the, quote, "extraordinary leadership of President Xi and China's economic resilience and vitality." They reportedly vowed to, quote, "maintain their strong commitment to the Chinese market." Xi assured the U.S. visitors that, quote, "China is planning and implementing a series of major steps for comprehensively deepening reform and steadily fostering a market-oriented, law-based, and world-class business environment. This will create broader development space for U.S. and other foreign businesses." Just what they wanted to hear. Finally, Niger ends its security agreement with the United States. The coup government in Niger is ending its security agreement with the United States that had allowed operation of a major counterterrorism base in the north of the country. Since the July 2023 coup, the Niger government has ousted French forces and now seems about to force the U.S. to dismantle its very expensive base, which houses some 1,000 military and civilian personnel. Closure of the base would be a major blow to drone surveillance operations against jihadist groups in the Sahel region of Central Africa. It would also signal that the Niger government is falling under Russian influence, just as has happened with Niger's neighbors, Burkina Faso and Mali. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Matea Carlin. In early March, High Country News released a story about underground seed banks and their possibility for restoring damaged ecosystems and protecting biodiversity. The article highlights how indigenous science and land knowledge is using natural regeneration to restore Western ecosystems that have been damaged by colonization. I spoke with author Josephine Woolington, a freelance journalist and musician based in Portland, Oregon, to learn more. How does indigenous knowledge of the land play an essential role in these restoration efforts in Oregon?
Yeah, so that was... One thing that was really striking is the contrast between indigenous scientists versus non-native scientists with more of a Western science background is that the native ecologists really emphasize time and patience and cultivating relationships with plants and with the landscape. To quote Lindsay McClary, again, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde restoration ecologist, she had said something along the lines of, you know, maybe the seed source is there and they just need a bit of time, and that there's value to pausing during restoration projects and to let the landscape talk to you. And so I want to emphasize, though, too, that it's not... Natural regeneration is not passive. A lot of these tribally led projects took a lot of time, a lot of research, a lot of active restoration. For example, the Stillaguamish Estuary, they excavated tidal channels using like a complex mathematical model of how many channels should be kind of maneuvering through the estuary. And so it's not kind of like just kick back and see what happens. It's understanding what the landscape was like kind of pre-colonization as much as they can, and then reconstructing that with patients.
Could you explain the concept of ecological memory?
That term, I might have come across it in a scientific article. I think about seed banks, and I've seen it appear in other writing about restoration. And so for me, how I interpret it is, for example, there's a former lake in the Willamette Valley called Lake Labiche, and it has really dark black soils. It's peat, so organic matter that has, plants that have decomposed over the thousands of years. And so that lake, the soil extends down 19 feet at some parts of the lake. And underneath the ground is our seeds and roots and bulbs. And those roots and bulbs and seeds or buds, they're on a different time scale than we are above ground. They are not, on the same temporal scale. So they can be waiting for decades, maybe even centuries, or there's been research that seeds can come back, after millennia. And so they're waiting for the right moment to regrow if there's enough sunlight. And so for me, it's quite inspiring to think that what was once, a grass seed farm in the Willamette Valley or an onion field in the Lake Labiche example still has the potential, still has that memory underneath the European crops, underneath the agriculture, to return to what the landscape was prior to colonization.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring up colonization. Could you speak a little more on what the role of colonization is in this issue and how you discuss it in your article?
Yeah, I mean, it's really colonization is, the heart of it, because it has transformed landscapes and people's lives and connections to these places so immensely. There, some places, how water flows through our watersheds has been turned completely upside down by irrigated agriculture, by dams that were all because of colonization. Agriculture in the Willamette Valley, this place should be bunch grass prairie. There was tons of camas here, lots of wet swales, wetlands, Wapato. But colonization and development has erased all of that. And so with this piece is when we're approaching ecological restoration, how do we keep the values that created these landscapes in the first place in mind during the restoration process? So meaning that prairies, they were created and maintained because of Native people. The Kalapuyans, for example, lived throughout the Willamette Valley. And one of the reasons why they were open prairie is because of their regular annual burns. And so when a non-native ecologist tries to restore that ecosystem without restoring how it was created in the first place, that raises really interesting philosophical questions about restoration and about how do you restore a landscape that was maintained and created by people, and we're not, able to restore that relationship fully?
In your article, you discuss a lot of fascinating examples of ecological restoration spearheaded by Indigenous groups. Were there any cases that particularly surprised or excited you?
So I think one of the ones that was the most surprising to learn about is sand dunes. And so native plants have returned within the Oregon Dunes National Recreational Area on their own after the Forest Service, which manages the dunes, bulldozed and has used some herbicide on the European beach grass. And so that's the, golden grass that we as Oregonians are very familiar with on the coast. And I think it was so surprising because I guess I had never really thought about what would have grown on the dunes. You know, growing up in Oregon, you kind of think that this colonized landscape is natural and what it has always looked like. So clear cuts in the Coast Range or the beach grass just creating a monoculture of basically like a wheat field along the ocean. But once the Forest Service started bulldozing some of the beach grass, dune plants like yellow sand verbena, which is a really cool succulent dune plant that grows in huge mounds and has an edible taproot with really pretty and fragrant yellow flowers that bloom in spring, that plant has come back and it's culturally important to people along the Northwest coast. But I spoke with Ashley Russell of the Coos Lower Umpqua Siuslaw tribe. And so other plants have also returned in the dunes as well. Beach lupin or seashore lupin, beach morning glory. I can't think of any others. But and so these plants have come back without any reseeding. And what I find interesting is that the Forest Service, though, is still kind of insisting that it needs to seed to get native plants to come back. And so this is an example of, well, if the plants are already coming back after, you know, only just maybe a year or a couple of years, why is there that urge to kind of force it or think that we need to have a heavier hand if the plants are kind of like, you know, responding to the restoration that's already been done?
What do you hope people take away from this article?
I think the biggest takeaway that I would, theme that I would hope people would take away is that a lot of restoration tends to be one size fits all. There's kind of the feeling that we broke it, we need to fix it. So restoration projects tend to be kind of cookie cutter. You clear invasive plants and then you plant a bunch of seeds or plantings. And that's kind of how it's approached in a lot of areas. But from talking with indigenous scientists is that is just kind of the opposite of how, you know, we should be approaching restoration. Is plants return to landscapes in stages. It takes a lot of time. Sometimes a site or a landscape might not be mature enough to be able to sustain certain plants that are, found in more mature landscapes. So like camas or wapato or sagebrush, they might not regrow immediately. So a lot of grants for restoration, they fund just 3 to 5 years of work, but plants are on a different time scale, and 3 to 5 years is a very short time. And we can't really expect to recreate these ecosystems kind of in an instant. And so that kind of Western urge to force things and do things quickly is just maybe not the best approach to ecological restoration. And maybe we need to listen to these or look to these tribally led projects that value time and trust.
If our listeners are interested in engaging more with your article, how can they do so?
Yeah, so the article is online at High Country News. The website is hcn.org. I would love it if anyone wanted to reach out directly to me. My direct email is my last name, Woolington, Woolington, .Josephine, Josephine, @gmail.com. And I always love hearing stories, maybe if you've experienced natural regeneration in your life or in any area that you have helped restore.
Do you have any last thoughts you'd like to share?
I think one of the more striking aspects of reporting this story was learning that what we see above ground is not necessarily the entire story of the landscape. A farm, for example, a grain field could be restored back to a wetland because the seeds and the bulbs are under the ground. And so I think it's really important to keep that in mind with ecological restoration. You know, you might go into a site and it's covered in reed canary grass, which is a invasive grass that takes over. But underneath the ground, there actually might be more native seeds than reed canary grass. Another example is there's been some interesting research from the University of Montana where a site covered in cheatgrass was actually found to have more native seeds underground than the cheatgrass above ground would have suggested. So we can't really make assumptions about what we see above ground and a site's potential because it's kind of hidden, and that ecological memory, as we talked about earlier, can be reawakened if we approach it the right way.
That was Josephine Woolington, a freelance journalist and musician based in Portland. We discussed her article in High Country News called Underground Seed Banks Hold Promise for Ecological Restoration. The article is about the ways that indigenous science and knowledge is using natural regeneration to restore Western ecosystems. More information at hcn.org. You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Matea Carlin.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Hi, KBOO listeners. My name is Carrie Cantrell, one of the show producers for the Let's Talk podcast.